Coming up on Tech Nation, I speak with Dr. Pedro Domingos, a professor of computer science at the University of Washington. He'll tell us what Google knows and what Twitter holds back, and about the search for the master algorithm. Then on Biotech Nation, Martin McGlynn and Dr. Stephen Yoon from Stem Cells, Inc. tell us about important new results treating cervical spinal cord injuries with stem cells, actually tens of millions of stem cells, and about a clinical study seeking to enroll new participants with cervical spinal cord injury. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Rework. That's R-E colon, short for in reference to work. Rework is an effort of Google's people operations and includes research, blogs, Twitter feeds, the modern day works. In a recent Rework entry written by Google People Operations analyst Julia Rozovsky, she reports on the efforts of her group to answer the question, what makes a Google team effective? After 2 years, 200-plus interviews with Googlers, and trying to pin down over 250 attributes, it turns out the answer is not just who is on a team, but rather the ecosystem. Success lies in how team members communicate with each other, how they structure their work, and how they view their work as making a contribution. Normally, I ignore these teamwork advisories because they often don't apply to technical teams. But this was Google, so I took a serious look. The people operations folks found five keys which typified the most successful teams. And first up was psychological safety. Can the members of a team take risks without fear? Fear of feeling insecure or embarrassed. You may not know this, but engineering and technical teams are known for being tough places to operate. In the old days, this could vary from being yelled at to ridicule to silent rejection to open shunning. You had better be right if you opened your mouth. One time at an engineering meeting at NASA, someone asked me to repeat something I'd just said. And when I did, I apparently misspoke. About 6 months later, I was talking with one of the engineers, and he suddenly smirked and said to me, "Boy, that time you said thus and so, you really lost credibility with everybody on the team." I said, "What?" He repeated it. I protested. I didn't say that. I said the opposite. That would be a ridiculous thing to say. Psychological threats can be overt or covert. You can be afraid that someone is going to criticize you out loud in front of other people, or find out something is believed about you which just isn't true. I remember thinking I couldn't remember everybody who was there. Just who had lost respect for me? And was this smirky guy even telling the truth? Whether you're the youngest member of the team, or the newest, or the only female, or the only whatever, on dysfunctional teams like these, you can't afford to be wrong. The next important feature for successful teams is dependability. Do you trust your colleagues to complete tasks to a high standard? I thought this went without saying until I recalled joining a new academic department. In the first meeting, we agreed to split up a task into three chunks and come back to the next meeting with each of us having our chunks done. I emailed mine as an attachment to everyone, and when I came to the next meeting, the department chair berated me for making everyone else look bad. "You mean you folks don't do what you say you're going to do? And you're mad when somebody does?" There are three more keys to successful teams, but we've run out of runway here. And I'm still cogitating on the first two. So I ask you, what's your life like at work these days? Feeling psychologically safe? people you work with complete tasks to a high standard? If no, it's time to rethink your work. If yes, count your lucky stars. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with computer science professor Pedro Domingos from the University of Washington. He's the author of The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Then on Biotech Nation, Martin McGlynn and Dr. Stephen Yoon from Stem Cells, Inc. They'll share important new results in their efforts to treat spinal cord injuries with tens of millions of stem cells, and about a clinical study seeking to enroll new participants with cervical spinal cord injury. We've all figured out that when two of us at the same time enters the same two words into Google, you get a slightly different response than I do. I asked University of Washington computer science professor Pedro Domingos, why is that?
Well, it's because Google knows about you, right? The searches are personalized. It has a learning algorithm that's figuring out what you're interested in, and you know, based on where you are and what other things you've done, it suggests different things, just like a person would, right?
But you're trying to find something new, and it's like, well, it must be the kinds of things that you like. How do you break through that?
Yeah, exactly. There's a very easy thing that you can do to break that, which is you go on the Chrome browser and you use incognito mode where it doesn't know who you are.
There's an incognito mode?
Yeah. Yeah. You just open a browser window incognito, and then all the personalization gets turned off. It's an extremely useful thing because it allows you to see the world without it having been designed for you. And sometimes that's actually important.
And so when you actually want to find out where the closest pizza restaurant is, you want to turn it back on.
Yeah, for example. Yeah. Or you might want to do both, right, and see what the difference is.
See what the difference is, what you're asking about. And then with Twitter, it doesn't just throw up all the tweets of all the people you're following?
No, that would be crazy. I mean, a lot of people are under the illusion that that's what happens, but that would be completely unmanageable, right, because there's too many. So it actually has to select some small number and put them in front of you. And again, it does that based on its judgment of your interests. Again, it's trying to learn, what your mind likes and you know, based on what other things you've, favorited or retweeted before and so on.
So if you've retweeted something, they figure you must like this.
Exactly.
And
But then the question is like, how do you generalize from, those retweets to a new thing that has never been seen before? This is actually the essence of the learning problem is, well, you're never going to see that thing again. Now that there's a completely new one in front of you, how do you decide whether, the user is going to like it or not?
Elvis is back from the dead. Obviously, there's no, there's nothing that came up to that. It was blank. Might just get sent it to the side because there's
depending on your interest,
it.
Right? You might not be interested in Elvis.
Now, it leads to wondering about other differences in everyday usage. I mean, this is sort of we're very close to controlling this, what we type, how we act. But something that happens for all of us is perhaps spam. It's like you can put a few words in, but it just seems like it's what gets put into spam and how you get around spam, that's constantly changing.
It is constantly changing because it's an arms race between the machine learning and the spammers, right? The machine learning learns to distinguish spam from regular email based on, for example, the words that appear and things like that. But then the spammers figure out a way to defeat that. And then the companies like Google and Microsoft, they run their learning programs again to try to now defeat what the spammers are now doing. So it's this endless game of cat and mouse. And you don't really know who's going to win in the end. Sometimes the spammers have the upper hand. Actually, right now, the spam filters have the upper hand. And, let's hope it stays that way.
I have to say that the spam filters are pretty good right now.
Yeah.
So, but, you know.
But they could come up with the next trick and then,
boom.
Yeah.
And then things would be flooding in. Now, here's another space where machine learning is obviously going on, and it seems to be a little overenthusiastic in my book. And that is the automatic detection of fraudulent use of credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. You know, let's say I even call the company up and say, hey, I'm traveling to Europe, and here's when I'm going to be there. And then I go over there, and I pay a bill in California, and it thinks it's a fraudulent use. You know, it's like, or I'm in California. I'm ordering something, and they charge me in London. And it's like, oh, fraudulent use, and they shut down my credit card.
This is a real, I think everybody has experienced that, right? And it's really annoying. And this is a really good example of the problem of whose interest is the machine learning serving, right? And this is really, you know, this is really one of the reasons why people need to understand what's going on. Because if they don't, then it'll serve somebody else's interests. Now, there's having the best possible learned model of fraud that you can. That's good for everybody except the fraudsters. But then the problem is that the you know, you're actually not liable at the end of the day, at least in the United States, for the fraud that happens with your credit card. Your company is, so you know it's they prefer to harass you, right? You know, 99 times out of 100, for the sake of the one time that it's a real fraud, for you it's a huge pain. But there's a knob on that machine learning algorithm that you could turn, right, to make those warnings come up less often. Another question is like, who should control that knob? Should it be the credit card company or should it be you, right? Right now it's the credit card company because you don't even know it exists.
Exactly. I did not know there was a knob there, but obviously there
is. We want to demand that knob be under our control.
Well, we've certainly learned a lot about knobs and things being under control with the latest revelations about the deceptive software in the VW for certain models in certain years, diesel models. And I thought it was fascinating. It figured out, you know, well, are you going a constant rate of speed? Are you not turning the wheel? You know, you must be in test mode because you couldn't possibly be driving down a highway.
Exactly.
This so we'll just put out some, we'll control things a different way.
Yeah, but again, this is a very good example of just the kind of, you know, world that we live in now, right? In the old days of mechanical engineering, all of this was completely impossible. But now, in essence, every car has in it a little brain, right? And the brain can tell whether the car is being test driven or not. And then if it's being test driven, it can behave differently from when it's not being test driven. And again, what has to happen here is that the regulators, right, like the EPA, has to get as smart as, you know, the Volkswagens of this world. Otherwise, the Volkswagens of this world will fool it, right? And, you know, this time they got caught, but think of all the things that are going on that aren't being caught.
I was thinking there might be some other cars that have this challenge.
Yeah, I mean, in fact,
they're
you know,
all kind of scratching their heads.
The European Union has all these environmental, you know, regulations, but there's this game that they all play where they kind of allow you to semi-cheat in all sorts of ways, you know, to tape the doors so you know, like the cracks so that the efficiency is great and whatnot. So and the U.S. is actually stricter in that regard.
We have to talk at some point in here about the word algorithm, because that's the master algorithm here,
right,
is what we're talking about here. What's the word algorithm mean?
Well, an algorithm is really just how we tell a computer to do what we want, right? It's a sequence of instructions, not unlike a cooking recipe, except a lot more detailed and precise. And algorithms are important because the world we live in today is made of algorithms. There's algorithms everywhere. There's algorithms in your car, we were just talking about. There's algorithms in your, you know, in your microwave. There's algorithms, you know, running the stock market in essence. So, you know, they are very much a part of our lives. Now, you know, in the old days, the algorithms had to be written by human programmers. The thing that's new about machine learning is that the computers are writing their own algorithms. They're trying to figure out what you want by looking at your data.
And let's face it, these machine learning technologies can work very well, like the financial markets, in politics, in international conflicts. We're talking about many, many kinds of things that no longer could be done by humans, that are now created, in a sense, by the human algorithms are creating more of them. And it's like, are we talking about a world that could be defined by dueling algorithms?
Well, it already is, right? So the society and the economy that we live in are already the result of these interacting learning algorithms. Like, for example, when you see a web page, right, the web page was not created in one place. It was the result of, you know, Google's models and the ads, you know, the companies that are pulling the ads, they have their own models of each other, of the process, of you, right? And these are all interacting with each other to produce the final result. Same thing in the stock market, right? All these different learning algorithms are trying to predict what each other is going to do. So, and I think, you know, what we're going to see in the future is that you have sort of like your own army of learning algorithms doing your job for you, and I have mine, and every now and then they meet and interact.
Ooh, sounds like a movie.
Well, it's like, you know, a lot of these things sound like a science fiction movie, except that they're already happening.
Now, you talk about Obama and Romney. What happened in that race?
Well, what happened is that a large part of the reason why Obama won the election was machine learning, right? So they were fairly close, right? And as usual, things came down to the swing states. And then, you know, Romney just did the traditional polling, and then they had like these, you know, broad demographic categories, like, you know, like let's advertise to, you know, suburban women in Ohio. And Obama instead used machine learning. So what they did was that they had the model of every individual swing voter. And every night they ran this program that they call the Optimizer, trying to predict who were the best swing voters to contact the following day. You know, the most likely to be persuaded by talking to them and then, you know, showing up at the polls and whatnot. And they ran this every day. And so thanks to machine learning, they were giving their campaigns to individuals as opposed to broad groups of people. And then they basically, I think they swept all the swing states that maybe won. And by larger margins, the people were predicting. So machine learning can decide an election. And in fact, now there's this race between the Republicans and the Democrats to see who can do the best, you know, machine learning, because, you know, they know it could make all the difference.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Pedro Dominguez. Dr. Dominguez is a professor of computer science at the University of Washington and a fellow of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. His book is The Master Algorithm: How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. So are you suggesting that there is a master algorithm, that we're sort of progressing toward writing it?
Yeah. I mean, in fact, you know, it's been called the holy grail of computer science, right? It's one algorithm that can learn anything from data. So once we have that algorithm, we won't need to program anything anymore, because the computers will do it for themselves. And also, you know, science will be done by algorithms. There will be this algorithm in all its, you know, different incarnations that will, you know, be discovering new physics and new biology and everything else as well. You know, it's in some sense like a grand unified theory of machine learning, analogous to, you know, what the standard model is for physics or the central dogma for biology.
Now, do we have a proof that such a master algorithm could exist?
There are yes and no, right? So there actually are already algorithms. So there are these different paradigms in machine learning, and they all have their own master algorithm. And they have a proof that that algorithm can learn anything from data if you give it enough data. So in that sense, they already exist, and, you know, some people believe that they have the master algorithm. The problem, though, is that that could be an infeasibly large amount of data and take, you know, too much computation. So the question is, can you have an algorithm that can learn given realistic amounts of data? And there are arguments for and against, right? So there are people that believe that we will find it, and there are some people who believe that we won't. But, you know, just to give you an example, right, your brain, right, is the master algorithm, right? Everything you know was learned by your brain. And some people, that's their approach, is to mimic the brain. Another master algorithm is evolution, right? Evolution is an algorithm, and it created all life on Earth. So clearly there are some very powerful algorithms out there, and the question is, can we discover how they work and do it with computers?
Wow. Pedro, you're completely crazy. You're a crazy guy. That's
only
it.
Partly.
Only partly. I like this. At the same time, I'm quoting you from an interview provided in the press materials. You say, the more intelligent the computers, the better, provided we stay in control. Provided we stay in control? How can we lose control? How would we even know it?
No, exactly. So this is crucial, right? I mean, a lot of people these days are worried about, you know, computers taking over and Terminator and whatnot. And if you talk to the AI experts, they don't really take that very seriously, right? But it does come down to this question of who stays in control, right? I think there's a very simple rule that we have to follow, which is only we humans get to set the goals. And then we check the results. The job of the computer, and this is actually what all machine learning, you know, and AI systems do, is they search for solutions to the problems that you set them. You say, find me a cure for cancer. And now these problems may be too hard for humans to solve, but not too hard for computers to solve. And the more intelligent they are, the better, right? We want them to be very intelligent, provided that they're only serving our goals. If we create, machine learning systems that are allowed to create their own goals, then that's a danger because who knows what their goals might wind up being.
Ah, so it's a question of setting the goals. It's no longer, well, the person has to program the computer. No, the person has to control the goal.
Yeah.
And then it can generate any kind of program, but it has to be within the goal.
Yeah, and you can also specify the constraints within which it is allowed to pursue that goal. Do not use more than this many resources. Right? Do not cross these lines. And in fact, this is actually how all machine learning algorithms work these days. Like, they work on a goal that is set by you. So,
intelligent slaves.
They're even less than slaves in some sense. In a way, the reason people have these confusions about intelligence is that it's hard to distinguish being intelligent from being human, right? In Hollywood movies, the robots are always, humans in disguise. But the real robots and the real, AIs, they are way more intelligent than we are in some ways already. And at the same time, they look nothing like a human being, right? They're just able to solve very hard problems because they have clever algorithms and a lot of computing resources, but they don't have a will of their own, right? They're not self-aware, they're not conscious, none of those things.
Now, you were talking about curing cancer, and I thought, well, let's talk about what kinds of problems you could use in the quest to cure or control cancer. And now it's clear that cancer is caused by mutations in our DNA and our own, which is the own basic programming of our human body. And when we have a tumor, the DNA of that tumor was mutated and is growing into a tumor. And that's different from the DNA in the rest of your body. And by not much, it's like just a couple of mutations here and there. So the cancer DNA is 3 billion pairs of nucleotides, which are 3 billion GCATs. And the non-cancerous are 3 billion GCATs. And they're almost identical, almost identical. We're looking for tiny needles in a very large haystack. And that's very good for a computer.
No, exactly. This is the kind of thing that is very hard for humans to do, but very easy for a computer to do. And in fact, there's two parts to this, right? One is to actually find those so-called SNPs, right? Those changes in the DNA. And there are, you can actually order that, from a company today. You send them, your tumor or a little slice of it, and it sends back, those mutations. But then the harder part of the problem is knowing now how your cancer's tumor differs from yours, what is the best drug for you? There isn't a single drug, and that's why curing cancer is so hard. So the cure for cancer is a machine learning program that learns to predict what the right drug for you is, given your genome, your medical history, the cancer's mutations, and anything else.
All of which can be coded into information.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we talk about machines on learning something? Here's a great example. And sometime in the last 10 years, my university's computer system decided that my middle name wasn't the four-letter Anne, A-N-N-E, but was in fact A-N-N. And every attempt we've had to correct this has only resulted in A-N-N being spread even further in the computer system. How do we unlearn a mistake? Do we have any work going on in that area?
Well, yes. This is a great example of why the problem today is that computers are too stupid and they've already taken over the world, right? It's not that they're going to get too smart and take over. They're like, they already do everything for us.
Look
and then
for
they
the
make
dumb
this,
ones?
Yeah. So the question is like, how do you make them smarter, right? Like, how do you give them common sense? And that can be, a computer can learn and a computer can forget, right? In fact, the better part of learning can actually be forgetting. It's figuring out where you were wrong and being able to start doing it differently. If the computer is just programmed, like I'm sure that computer was, it can't do that until somebody comes in and fixes it. But if the computer is learning, right, it should be able to change its behavior just like humans do. Right? Again, people today, they don't know that there's a learning algorithm there, right? And so they don't, you should be able to tell the computer, like once and for all, look, here's my name, and then they will fix, where they have it wrong. And then they will remember that just if it was a human, right? So there's no reason that can happen.
Well, my middle name is kind of funny because it doesn't really make a really big difference here. But I'm really more concerned with people who run into financial trouble. It's like, whether it's unfortunate behavior because of circumstances or misassignment, Are we ever going to solve those?
I think we are. But exactly, this takes AI as opposed to traditional programming, right? I think people have no idea how fragile the computer-driven world is that we have today. We have computers doing all these things. It's amazing. But they're also full of these errors all over the place and things that break, and we don't even know about most of them, right? You contrast that with just like the robustness and the resilience of a human being. And that is the path that we have to travel. And I think the key thing that we need for that is machine learning, right? We humans are good and strong and get better because we have the ability to learn, and computers have to have that as well.
I got from your book, and I get from listening to you, that it's actually machine learning is something very specific, and it operates within a set of parameters, and it can only do certain things. It can't come and ask you out for a date and take you out.
No, exactly. So here's an analogy, right? Every technology, in some sense, is extending your natural abilities. It's a superpower, like a telephone lets you communicate at a distance. An airplane lets you fly. And machine learning is another of those superpowers. You just have to learn how to use it. It's a superpower that lets you predict things, and it's a superpower that makes the world adapt itself to you without you actually having to make it happen. But you have to be aware that you have it, as you know. Otherwise, things just are changing in ways that you're not really understanding, you know, how they're going on. But you really should think of machine learning as just, it's an extension of yourself. It's something that, you know, turns you into a superhuman in some ways, in the way that other technologies do.
Well, just quickly, right at the end here, people can get all that, but in the end, they're like, wait a minute, what about my job? Are jobs going to change dramatically with all of this machine learning?
Yes, they are. So some jobs will disappear. Many new jobs will also appear. But I think for the main, what's going to happen is that existing jobs are going to change, right? You know, like I want to do my job. You know, the best way to protect my job from automation is to automate it myself. I want to do my job taking advantage of machine learning and doing the things that the machine learning couldn't do. It's like having a horse, right? If you have a horse, you don't try to outrun the horse. You just ride it. And machine learning is a kind of horse that you can ride. So what you want to do is you want to figure out, like, what are all the places in my professional life where machine learning already plays a part or can play a part because I want it to? And then you just make that part of your, you know, toolkit, if you will. And with that way, I think you will keep your job for a long time.
Get out in front.
Exactly.
I heard that. Pedro, such a pleasure. Come back. See us anytime.
Thanks for having me.
My guest today is Pedro Dominguez. Dr. Dominguez's book is The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. It's published by Basic Books. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, new developments in neural stem cell transplantation for patients with cervical spinal cord injury, and a research study seeking to enroll more patients now. Stay with us.
The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, important developments in the area of stem cell therapy for spinal cord injury. I'm speaking with Martin McGlynn, the CEO of Stem Cells, Inc., and Dr. Stephen Yoon, the Chief Medical Officer and Vice President of Clinical Research. Well, Martin, welcome back to Biotech Nation, and Stephen, welcome for the very first time.
Thank you, Moira. It's great to be back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We're going to be talking about some incredible scientific and treatment breakthrough news today. So I really feel like we need to lay the groundwork so people will understand what really happened here. And I just sort of want to start, perhaps, Martin, with you reminding us about stem cells and about Stem Cells, Inc. and what you've been doing all these years.
Well, thank you, Moira. As I said, it's great to be back again. So this cell, this neural stem cell, which I have called the God cell of the central nervous system, because it really is, it's the building block of all the cells in the central nervous system. And when we talk about the central nervous system, we're talking about the brain, the spinal cord, and the eye. So this cell was discovered at the company in 1999. We transplanted our first patient in November of 2006, when we transplanted a lot of cells into the brain of children. 5 years ago, we initiated this endeavor, transplanting the cells into the spinal cord. We started, first of all, in the chest area or the thoracic region, and then with a very good safety profile and evidence that the cells were doing something essential and helpful in thoracic injury, then we got the green light to move further up into the cord, up into the cervical region, which is where the majority of injuries occur. And there's also a maxim that the further up the cord you go, the more is at risk and the more is at stake. But also the corollary is the greater the potential to do good.
So you've taken neural brain cells, if you will, or neural tissue cells, and then you've amplified those and stored those. How do you get them back into the patient?
Well, Stephen, I think, would be the best person, being the neurosurgeon, to answer that question.
So the short answer is that we directly transplant them into the tissue or the anatomic region of interest. So in the indications in which involving the brain, we transplant them directly into the brain through a neurosurgical procedure. For the spinal cord, we expose the spinal cord through, again, a very standard neurosurgical operation. And then looking at the back of the cord, we can determine where the cells need to go in relative to where the injury level is. So the cells are very much placed directly right into the injured tissue.
So we're talking primarily paraplegics or people who have lost some portion of control here?
So the first study that we did was in paraplegics, meaning that they had a spinal cord injury lower in their spinal cord, in the thoracic cord, which is at the level of the chest. Again, those are patients who, as a result of the injury, lose use of their legs. As you go higher in the spinal cord, as Martin referred to, those are patients with cervical spinal cord injury, and those patients lose both the use of their arms and their legs. And so sometimes those patients are referred to as quadriplegics.
And where would Christopher Reeve have been?
He would have been considered a very, very severe form of quadriplegic injury. The higher you are in the cervical spinal cord, the more impairment you will have neurologically, meaning not only will you lose the use of your legs and arms, but also potentially breathing. And so he had a very rare form of spinal cord injury that was so high in the cervical cord that actually the nerves, if you will, that control breathing were actually impaired and injured as well.
Okay, now we're here to talk about a specific study that's underway, which is a little shock. I think it's the first time I've ever had a study underway that we actually could talk about. Normally, everything is all silent while the study is underway. What's going on here?
The reason we can talk about this study as it's still underway is because we've designed it in a fashion that we have three compartments to it. So the first compartment involved six patients who have the condition we've described, the cervical spinal cord injury, and all six of those patients received the cells. This is what you call an open label design. So we all know who gets the cells.
There's nobody, do they get them or not get
right,
them? Everybody
right.
gets
yeah, there's
them.
No control here. Everybody, all six patients got the cells. And we designed it in a fashion that we wanted to test three doses of cells because nobody has ever done this before. So we wanted to know how many cells could that region of the cord actually tolerate. It was more about space, fluidics, and physics because we're really testing for volume. So we started at 15 million cells. The first two patients got 15. The next two got 30. And then the next two got 40 million cells. So our experience in that initial experiment convinced us that we would be able to go into the next cohort or the next segment with the top dose with 40 million cells. Now, this cohort is the blinded controlled cohort. So when you enroll in the study, half of the patients will be randomized into a treatment arm where they will get the cells. The other half will be randomized into a control arm. Now, we do not do sham surgery. We don't pretend to put cells into the cervical region of the cord. That's a no-no. That's got all kinds of issues. Mm. So the patient has to play the game. So the patient knows whether or not they've had the surgery. And what we ask them to do is to essentially not tell the independent rated examiners who are evaluating their performance and all kinds of other measurements whether or not they got the cells. So there will be 40 patients in that second cohort, and that's already underway, and we've enrolled two-thirds of them. There's a third cohort, which will be another open label, six patients, and this open label third cohort will be less severely injured, and we want to see if it's worth doing to see if we can help those patients also who are less severely injured. But we'll be informed by the previous cohorts. So now back to the beginning, in case I lost everybody. Three compartments. The first six patients in cohort number one all got the cells. And that's the group we were talking about. We announced the incredible results on yesterday. We're halfway through that. And we announced the results at 6 months. We have another six to go.
Okay, now my understanding is that the idea is inject the cells, and in this case, three different volumes of cells, counts of cells, 15 million, 30 million, and 40 million. And then you're going to check the differential between what their ability to perform, if you will, at the beginning, and then 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months?
Yeah, so we look at patients in terms of their neurological exam, how strong they are, and how good their dexterity is before they're transplanted. And then we examine them with the same tests at 3, 6, 9, and 12 months after transplant.
Now, tell us about those tests. I mean, how difficult are they?
So for you and I, they're normal tests, and we'd have no trouble completing them. But for a patient with spinal cord injury, they'll have varying degrees of disability and impairment. Some will be able to do a part of the test, and some won't be able to do any part of the test. The test tests a number of different functional skills or dexterity or fine motor control of the hands. It's a test that range from being able to thread a nut onto a screw, so picking up coins and putting them in a slot, to able to pour water from a jar, and able to pick up a key from the table, insert it into a lock, and then turn the lock. So those are all skills not just purely of strength, obviously, but of dexterity and fine motor control.
You're listening to Biotech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Martin McLinn, Chief Executive Officer of Stem Cells, Inc., and Dr. Stephen Huhn, Stem Cells Chief Medical Officer and Vice President of Clinical Research. So now, Martin, you've just said you had your first cohort of six subjects, and it's only 6 months down the line, and you're already coming out to tell us things. What happened?
Well, we had planned to take a look at 6 months because our expectation and observation from the phase 1-2 study that we conducted in the thoracic region, we noticed that after 3 months approximately, we started to see effect and that the effect was durable. So for that reason, we rightly, I think, projected that in the cervical region, we should start looking at around about the same time, but just to be to be sure and careful, we said, let's wait till the 6 months. Let's wait until all of the six patients have reached and have been checked at the six-month time frame. And we can do that because it's an open-label study. Okay, in the second cohort, which is randomized, we can't do this kind of thing because we completely blow it. So this is part of the one of the benefits of the design of the study is to actually allow us and to take a look and say, yeah, look, this is promising. We're getting some very interesting results. Now, in less than 6 months' time, we will have the data for all six patients at the 12-month time frame, and for them, the study's over. One of the things, of course, that we're hoping is that patients who, and their caregivers and clinicians and so on, who are on the sitting on the fence, not quite too, you know, will I, won't I, yeah, the thoracic region study was very convincing, but I've got cervical, is this something that I really want to put at risk? I'm okay now, I'm functioning, I'm coping, I'm not
really... How far away from injury are these patients?
Stephen?
So these are not patients who were injured shortly ago. These are patients who are anywhere between 10 and 23 months after injury. And that's important because most patients who have spinal cord injury have a period of recovery. So there's the initial trauma, and then many of those patients will regain some type of muscle function, some type of muscle control. But that typically starts to plateau about 3 or 4 months after injury. So our trials are specifically targeting patients who are well beyond that acute phase and where we don't expect to see any changes in terms of spontaneous recovery.
So we're talking about it's been stable for a while now, and we haven't seen any changes.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Mike.
Not only have we not seen changes, you would not expect to see any changes at this stage. And, you know, rightfully so, science and medicine is populated with a lot of skeptics. And, of course, one of the first things the skeptic will say is, oh, no, this the patients are just recovering, you know, on their own. And this is just spontaneous recovery and so on. So the fact that we wait so long before we intervene with the cells doesn't absolutely 100% deal with that issue, because there's always the, you know, the remaining lingering question and doubt. But it's clear this is not random. It's clear there's something really dramatic going on.
So what happened, Stephen?
So we were very pleased and excited to see that when we tested the patient's strength of their muscles and measures of dexterity, that in 4 of the 6 patients, we saw a pattern of not only improved strength, but improved fine motor skills. So when we compared how they were before transplant to how they were post-transplant, we see that at the end of 6 months, 4 of our 6 patients had increased performance on not only strength and how strong their muscles were in their arms and their hands, but also that they could do very specific dexterity skills better. The patients who couldn't pick up a key from the table surface and put it into a lock could now do that. Patients who could not pick up a bolt or a little nut from the table surface and put them onto a screw and thread it could now do that. So those are examples of not only something that requires a degree of strength, but also a degree of dexterity and function.
Another one that struck me was, you know, unscrewing the top off a plastic water bottle and being able to pour water from the bottle into a container. And you know, it struck me because I'm not a clinician, and I'm not on the front lines of taking care of these patients. But one of the things that struck me when we ask around and we say, you know, what is the most important thing in the minds of these patients and patients who have this cervical injury? And a lot of people would say, well, they would love to be able to walk. But the thing that comes out all the time consistently is independence, to have some degree of independence. Whether that's the ability to operate a motor-controlled wheelchair or whether that's the ability to take care of some basic fundamental bodily needs or whether it's the ability to pick up something or move something.
Run a remote control.
Right.
And I live on that.
Yeah. I mean, so personally, when I first heard the description of one of these patients being able to, for the first time, pick up a key, insert it into a lock, and turn the key. Now, the first image that came into my mind was driving. But everybody said, no, wait a minute, you're getting ahead of yourself here. Let's think about driving a wheelchair, for example, and to be able to move around and go from one side of the room or into another room and so on and do so without having a caregiver or without having to wait for a caregiver to do that for you. That's got to be tremendous.
Now, you said 4 out of 6. What about the other two? Do we have any sense what happened there?
So the other two patients had either stable function and strength or a slight decrease in their function or strength. And again, we know that in spinal cord injury patients, some of those patients can actually lose a little bit of strength and function over time. But the change that we saw was very, very mild and actually in many ways unrecognized by the patient or the investigator. It was something simply that we could see as a test score.
So did no harm.
Did no harm, exactly. And this is a very important part of what we're trying to do because, as you can well imagine, spinal cord injury is a very devastating disease. And so we are approaching this in a way to leave a therapeutic dose of cells in a very serious type of operation. And it's very important as a result of that we show that we're not doing any harm to the spinal cord. And we showed that in our thoracic study where the patients didn't have any change or loss of function. And we're seeing the same type of observations in our cervical study, is that what we're doing in terms of the patients are not producing any harm.
Do we expect over the next 3 months, which get to the 9-month, 12-month mark, that we will see anything given our experience with animal studies?
It's a good question. And the trajectory of the effect of a stem cell probably starts to happen within months. And, of course, we'd like to see patients continue to improve, and that's going to be the power of looking at the data as we have more data points for each of those patients in our first cohort of the trial. We saw a trend happening in our thoracic study where we first noticed it about 3 months in terms of the gains in sensation that patients had, but we saw that signal build and endure through the 12 months. So it's very much something we're going to look closely in our cervical study to see what we are appreciating that 3 and 6 months might continue to evolve and amplify even further.
So if I may also, you know, if a spinal cord injury patient survives the original insult and if they don't have the ability to actually use muscles, atrophy is always a concern. So it's, you know, physical therapy is a critical and important part of caring for patients with spinal cord injury. But motivation is also an issue. And so, you know, why should I worry about keeping my body in good physical shape if there's no therapy out there that I can benefit from? Well, now we're here to say that here's a reason for you now to start thinking about working on the physical condition of your body. And hopefully,
this will connect because the spinal cord to those muscles,
right? So you want the patient to be in as best a physical condition as they possibly can be, and then receive the cells and have good muscular conditioning and good muscular function. So now they have a reason to work even harder in the gym. It's hard for everybody, I know, but I think the key message here is hope and the prospect that, you know, you can really motivate now all kinds of physical therapy and exercise and activities to keep your body in good health and in good shape to the best of your ability.
And remember that, you know, as a neurosurgeon, we're used to taking things out of the brain and spinal cord, but now we're putting something in. So it's a little bit of a new paradigm in terms of treatment that we're introducing a cell into the spinal cord here that we think is going to do some good for the spinal cord. So you have to inject enough of those cells to try to make a difference. We think part of this may be a game of numbers. So the more cells you can put in that are safe, perhaps larger the effect. So that's why it was important in our first part of the study to truly identify what we thought was the highest number of cells and volume, if you will, that we could put into the spinal cord that would then hopefully induce effect in the second part of our study, which is where we're really going to be testing this.
Now, I hate to ask a scientist to guess here, but Dr. Yoon, what do you think is happening with those cells? What do you think is going on?
So it's a great question, and we could go on for a long time about what we think the theory might be. Some people refer to this what's called technically as the mechanism of action. So how are the cells determining an effect? And it's probably an oversimplification, but a neural stem cell is probably a smart cell. And in many ways, it may be both the architect and the carpenter for a particular problem. In other words, it seems to emerge from our data in animal studies that the cell can understand the environment to which it's been placed. And then it understands from that what needs to be done in terms of, well, what structures need to be replaced, what cells need to be replaced. And then it goes that next step further and replaces those cells. So the cell goes in as a neural stem cell, but then, as Martin referred to, it can become the building blocks of the spinal cord or the brain. And the two most important cells are either neurons, or oligodendrocytes. And oligodendrocytes is the type of cell that creates the insulation around our nerves that make our nerves work better. And we know in spinal cord injury that both of those types of cells are damaged or are lost. And so neural stem cell transplantation offers the opportunity to replace those injured or damaged cells. So I think a lot of the mechanism or how the cells are helping are probably replacing those specific cells in patients with spinal cord injury.
Now, Stephen, you were a professor of neurosurgery at Stanford Medical School, chief of pediatric neurosurgery at Stanford's Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. What made you leave that cutting-edge environment and come to Stem Cells, Inc.?
So surgery as a career is very, very engaging, and it's terribly rewarding, but it's one patient at a time. And to have the opportunity to work at the scale that we can in biotech for creating a treatment that can affect a whole class of disease, a whole population of disorders, is very intriguing. And many of us go into medicine because we love the idea of research. And after many years of seeing patients who have terrible neurological diseases that have no hope right now, and our conventional approaches have not done well, I was very intrigued by the possibility of using cells and cell transplantation as a way to approach these diseases. And spinal cord injury has long captured our imagination as physicians about what can we do to restore function, because these patients are otherwise healthy but have just a very small, narrow area of injury in their body to a very specific piece of their body, and that's the spinal cord. But as a result, they have a lifelong area of disability, of impairment. So I think when you look at the strength of the data that we can generate in the laboratory and the potential that that could hold for these patients, for me it was a decision to enter in to do research, which has become equally rewarding to my clinical practice.
And reaches so many more people.
Exactly.
Now, this current phase, the middle phase, how long will that take to play out?
We expect that, hopefully after this, Moira, we'll have some impact on the number of patients who are desirous of signing up to enter the study. But with the current rate, we would anticipate that we will complete enrollment in this group around the second or early third quarter of next year. And so because we wait 12 months and then we look at the data, we would expect that we will have final results for the first two cohorts in the third quarter of 2017, which in the biotech world, as you know, is not a lot. That's a blink. That's a blink of an eye.
But we need those patients.
Yes.
People who want to be subjects in this study, can they be anywhere in the world? Do they need to be in Southern California? Where do they need to be?
They need to be in the United States. And we're hoping shortly that we'll also be able to extend into Canada, where we also did in our phase 1-2 study. We had two centers in Canada, one in Toronto and one in Calgary, transplanted patients. So we're hoping that Canada will join in shortly. So this will be in North America with Canada in. And so anywhere in North America, Canada, or the United States, because it's a multi-center trial. We currently have 12 sites throughout the United States actively recruiting and enrolling patients, and we hope to add a couple more in Canada, maybe one more in the United States. So in total, our expectation will be to have 15 sites up and running. You can go onto our website, stemcellsinc.com, go to the clinical section, and you can learn all about the study, and you can see which centers are enrolling and which one is closest to you, and you can go direct to the center.
How many more people do you need?
We have one-third of the 40. So we need another, do the math, 25 patients.
It's okay. We're not depending on math from you guys.
So another 25 patients, of whom half of those will actually receive the cells.
So there's a chance
it could be you. Absolutely.
It could be you. And you should be at least a year out from your injury.
No, actually, so anywhere no earlier than 4 months after injury.
So we're willing to take patients.
And that 4 months kind of represents the time when a lot of that spontaneous recovery will have already evolved. And so there beyond, we don't again expect to see much spontaneous improvement.
So between 24 months.
Okay, where do you expect to go from here? Let's just take that this is very positive. It will be released. It will become a standard of care. but these are for the stabilized patients beyond that. What's next?
In spinal cord injury?
And anything else it'll work on.
This is
the platform technology of enormous – I mean, nobody has been able to do this before.
Exactly, and that's a great reminder. It is a platform technology, and we're interested in bringing therapies for the brain and for the eye as well as the cord. But job one in spinal cord injury is to get the phase two study, control study completed, look at the data, and validate that this, in fact, does convey meaningful clinical benefit to the patients. Then you have a conversation with the FDA. You lay out the data. And the FDA is doing all kinds of very innovative things now to bring therapies that appear to be working to the patients sooner rather than later. So our expectation, if all of this data holds up and we come out of the phase, out of the second cohort of this phase two study with confirmation of data, then we would sit down with the FDA and lay it out and say, look, what's the fastest route for us to get this therapy into the hands of the surgeons and into the spinal cord injury community? So that's a to-be-determined answer, I know, but I wish I could be a little bit more forthright, but it's going to be a negotiation with the FDA.
Well, I have to say that your studies are some of the most interesting studies, no matter what you're studying. It's the old, well, we'll just try it and some of the patients will get it or not. You spend a lot of time developing these protocols.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a new area and you have to be creative. And the fact that it's a new area allows us to be innovative. And I think that will really help accelerate our development. It's something that I think the FDA is starting to recognize that we can be creative in this area and starting to understand the potential.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Good luck and come back. Keep us informed.
We certainly would love to do that. Thank you, Moira.
Thank you.
Martin McGlynn is the CEO of Stem Cells, Inc., and Dr. Stephen Yoon is the Chief Medical Officer and Vice President of Clinical Research. More information is available on the web at stemcellsinc.com. That's stemcellsinc.com. If you'd like to explore enrollment in the current Stem Cells, Inc. clinical study evaluating the safety and potential benefit of neural stem cell transplantation in patients with cervical spinal cord injury, more information is available at sciresearchstudy.com. That's sciresearchstudy.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcorp.